Kennedy, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care for all the lonely people? Where do they all come from?
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guests today for return engagement, Phil Jahan and Larry McWilliams. We're talking about Twin Towers fakery. Were the buildings already prepped for demolition? Had they been stripped of their contents? Are the alleged deaths associated with the destruction real or fakery? Phil and Larry have set up a website for you to visit at letsroll911.info. Letsroll911.info. Phil and Larry, it's a great pleasure to have you back on the show again.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jim. Thanks for having us.
Great to be back so quick, Jim. Thanks.
Nice to have you both back. I take it you guys have got a fair amount of feedback from the first show.
Oh, we got a ton of feedback, and it's all been positive. Everybody, it seems there's something in this for everybody to love.
tell us a little bit about it. I always love to hear about feedback from the shows. What seemed to draw the most interest, or was it across the board?
It was a little bit of everything. There were some people that loved the idea that the jumpers were fake. There was a lot of people that really got excited about the idea that the Twin Towers were empty and possibly gutted before 9/11, and this explains the missing contents in the debris pile as well as the missing people. There was a few things that we didn't really get to touch on last time. One of our discoveries along the way, and it was just kind of one of those aha moments as you're looking at the pictures, we noticed that all the pictures of the Twin Towers on 9/11, except for a few exceptions, they're dark, Jim. All the lights are out. Did you ever notice this, or have you ever heard anything about
this? I think it's very strange. It would be very odd for that to be the case, because there should have been masses of workers populating the buildings virtually from top to bottom.
Yeah, there was a jumper, I believe, from the North Tower, and he is falling out the side of the building, and there's a long pan shot of the entire span of the building going up, and you can only count like 7 lights on. There should be thousands of lights on. The whole place should be lit up. And with those buildings, normally you can see the lights on during the daytime. For the listeners out there, we've created some of the material for the talking points we're going to be going through on the show. If you could go to letsroll911.info, and scroll down to the second post.
Okay. Scrolling down to the second post.
Yeah,
yes.
You see a picture. You can stop when you see the picture of Edna Cintron and the links above that.
Right.
The first link that's on the top, if everybody could open it, 9/11 triplets separated at birth, maybe open that in a new window.
Oh, really?
These are some of the things that we wanted to touch on tonight. We released this about August 4th, so about a week ago, and this gives you an idea. This is just one avenue of some of the things that they pulled with the victims on 9/11. There's three people that we looked at in this story. One was Ed Luckett, and then another one was Carlton Bartels, and another fellow was Michael Terrell. Do you have this open, Jim?
Yeah, I've got the window open, yes.
Do you see any similarity between these men's faces?
Well, I'm scrolled down about a third of the way, and I find Carlton Bartell, and then Ed Blockett, and Mike Tarot. Yeah, there is quite a bit of similarity, I think, Tarot and Blockett. This is tricky business, of course. Jack White is so good at this.
If you look at their faces, there's a distinguishing characteristic in Michael Turow's face and Carlton Bartell's face that make them almost a perfect match, and it's the forehead wrinkles. You'll notice in Carlton Bartell, the bottom forehead wrinkle, just goes south over his left eye, and you have the same issue with Michael Turow, and to some extent the same problem with Ed Luckett. Michael Turow was a flight attendant on Flight 11. Carlton Bartell and Ed Luckett, these two fellows both worked in the same office at Cantor Fitzgerald at the North Tower.
Yeah, tell us more. It would be striking to have two guys who look so much alike working for the same company all by itself. But
Well, it's what they did. With some of the people that they have that we believe are real people, that they used, we believe that a lot of actors were used. And because it was such a big operation, they fell back into, economy of actors. One person being able to do three or four or five different things. And you see this theme through 9/11. And, you see it no better than with, right here with Luckett, Bartels, and Terrell. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Larry?
No, I think we've seen it, as a consistent thread as we've investigated these passengers. We keep finding groups, essentially, of faces that all have really important characteristics to the makeup of the face that seem to be woven through more than one passenger or World Trade Center victim.
And I see as I scroll a little further that you have all three of them not listed in the Social Security Death Index, which seems very strange if indeed they died on 9/11.
Yeah, and on top of that, I think there was only one of them that was in the Victims Compensation Fund. Isn't that correct, Larry?
Yeah, that's correct. Only, I believe, I want to say it's Michael Tarot that was the VCF, and only one of the three.
Yeah, that's what it says down here. Michael Tarot is the only one of the three whose family received victims' compensation funds.
If you really think about, the victims' compensation fund and the fact that Carlton Bartell and Edward Luckett, neither of their families, claimed the money. I mean, everybody's got their favorite charity. Everybody's got their favorite, cancer organizations, organizations, all sorts of organizations that need money. Salvation Army, Red Cross, you name it. For people to pass up, what amounted to be somewhere between $1 and $3 million in the Victims' Compensation Fund is really unthinkable. It just doesn't happen.
A previous a student of Scholars, a member of Scholars, did a study of the 19 persons who allegedly made phone calls from the planes and found of the 19, only one of them was listed in the Social Security Death Index, and none of them had family members who received benefits from the Victims' Compensation Fund.
And I think we discussed the EXIF data last time we were on, and I think another common thread we found is also, just like your student scholar, we found that the ones with the EXIF data that predates 9/11 also tend to be the ones that have active families, active actor families, I should say.
Oh, really? That have associations with the acting profession? Have members?
Yes, absolutely. And also they do tend to be the families who end up in the limelight consistently and are the founders of, the family organizations, et cetera, and so on. So not only is it a red flag that something was wrong because the EXIF data predates 9/11, but it seemed to be an excellent indicator as to where we needed to investigate, because it almost invariably led to a good find.
Very, very interesting. Are any of these people aware of the role they're playing here? I mean, you wonder if they knew it in advance. Were they hired specifically with knowledge that they were going to be portrayed as victims of 9/11?
Well, there was one, as a matter of fact, that Larry just released this week, Gwendolyn Briley Strand. She was in the documentary, The Falling Man. Have you ever heard of that documentary?
No, tell me about it.
Well, it's a documentary about one of the jumpers. And, you know, he's a fellow that, you know, had his hair shaven close to his head. And, you know, the whole documentary was about this jumper and trying to find out, you know, who he belonged to, you know, if anybody could identify him. And the documentary was basically a propaganda piece to bring home the horror of 9/11, to bring home the emotional element of the death and, you know, the jumpers, you know, the choices that they, you know, faced that day. And, you know, Larry just did the whole story. Larry, why don't you, you know, break out into Gwendolyn Briley Strand?
Sure, I'd love to. We started looking at Gwen Strand when we were looking at the jumpers very carefully and trying to really dissect the operation that went on that day. And we started looking at that documentary, and some of the things she said just didn't fly exactly right. She said things like, you know, when you saw Jonathan, he was walking, he was always walking and talking and smiling, and, you know, why would somebody say something? It just didn't make any sense. So I looked a little bit on Gwendolyn Briley Strand, and it didn't take long. I found that she was an actress indeed, and she's represented by the Buchwald Agency, and the link is there in the thread. And not only is she an actress, but she also does a one-woman show, The Harriet Tubman Story, and it's been acclaimed, and she does it all over the place. And because of that, she has her own website to promote the Harriet Tubman Show outside of the Buchwald Agency. So I went over there to her website, and she lists her acting resume, and this is in the thread as well. She lists her acting resume, and if you go down and look at commercials that she's done on her acting resume, you notice that she's done many, many government commercials for several government agencies. And among them, she lists that she did, it's listed under commercials as a 9/11 FEMA commercial. Now, I don't recall ever having seen a 9/11 FEMA commercial. I can't imagine why FEMA would have been advertising about 9/11. Before or after or anything else, and of course a search for FEMA 9/11 commercial doesn't turn anything up, because of course there would be no such thing. But she just wanted to make sure that the acting that she did and got paid for in this role in 9/11, you know, went on her resume so it wouldn't get lost. And there it is, just as plain as day for anybody to see. She's self-proclaiming that she was a 9/11 actress.
That's very, very interesting, Larry. You haven't spoken to this woman, have you?
No, not yet. No, yeah. We haven't yet.
That might be a good one to pursue. That's very, very intriguing.
Well, what's interesting is her brother was supposed to be one of the jumpers. And if you watch The Falling Man, the documentary, when it gets to the end, you know, she just, I mean, everything is wrong. Everything in what she's saying, it's, you know, they're trying to identify this as her brother. And she says, well, I think it is my brother, you know, because of the orange shirt. You know, before, you know, the orange shirt, I wasn't sure. And then I asked, you know, the family about it, and they said he was always in that orange shirt, you know. And they start wrapping up the movie, and she's like, well, it really doesn't matter if it's my brother. You know, she kind of gives, you know, one of these lines that, you know, it could be anybody. You know, to identify him would be to take, you know, to remove his identity. And all this... It was just one long infomercial, really. I guess she properly categorized it in her resume.
Fascinating.
So the other thing about her is we believe that she might have played a dual role in 9/11. If you scroll down in her thread, you'll see a picture of her covered and dust.
Yeah. How far down? How far down on the side? I'm halfway down right now. Back up, right, I think.
Right underneath the FEMA commercial, isn't it, Larry?
I believe so, yeah. It should be towards the end of the original post.
Toward the bottom, okay.
And Larry found this the other night, and if you look at the woman that's covered in dust, I mean, you know, it's hard to tell with the picture, but we believe that that's Gwendolyn Briley Strand again.
I'm not finding it. It's on the same page?
Yeah, it's right underneath the resume, you know, where we, with the September 11th FEMA circled, and then there's a little yellowish picture with a black lady that's covered in dust.
Okay, I'm going back. I'm scrolling back down again.
Yes. Underneath the YouTube, underneath the Don Buchwald and Associates, underneath her picture, it's like the fifth picture down in her thread.
So I need to have opened her thread, do I?
Yeah, that was in the radio show thread, the talking points in the radio show. Open it in a different window, and you'll be able to see that.
Oh, okay. I think I need to go back. Yeah.
I didn't point it out in the thread, but I did notice when you blow that that picture up of her covered in dust, if you blow it up and look real careful, she's wearing pearls around her neck in that photo, but if you look real careful, she's wearing a very thin gold chain, and which is identical to the one she's wearing in the Falling Man commercial, infomercial interview, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, I see that now, and I do believe it's the same woman.
She has fairly distinct facial features.
Okay, I think I'm in the right page now.
You know, let us know when you get to the picture. It's the last picture in that thread. She's covered in dust. She's the only one in the picture. She's in a dress.
I'm not finding it for whatever reason.
Okay. Well,
what should the link say? The radio show tonight? Is that the right one? Or
no, you have to. Yeah, there's Gwendolyn Briley Strand, and
yeah, right at the very top of the page. It's the second link at the top of the radio show page, above the picture of the hole with Edna Cintron in it.
Oh, above the picture of the hole with Edna Cintron on it. Okay.
Gwendolyn Briley Strand, Falling Man star, admitted 9/11 actor.
Okay.
Anyways, while we got the dead time here, we're also going to be talking about that picture. That's coming up next.
I see it. Gwendolyn Briley Strand. I see it now. Okay, I'm there now. Okay, the Falling Man star admitted 9/11 actor. That's her, huh? She's part 8 of 8. And
yeah, that's her on the YouTube.
And I go down to the bottom. And you're wondering if this is her also in this covered with dust here, huh?
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Well, it certainly could be.
Oh, it certainly could be. I mean, it's nearly identical. It's hard to tell with her covered in dust, though. But they did have an economy of actors, and that's something else that we wanted to touch on tonight. We didn't get a chance to talk about this last time, but one of the things that we, you know, sometimes it's not what's in the photograph or, you know, what's in the video. Sometimes it's just the lack of the photograph or the video itself. Some of the things that we've normally seen at other disasters or, you know, that we would expect to see at the World Trade Center, we would have expected to see cameras on the long train of people coming out of the World Trade Centers for exit interviews, looking for people that are injured, people, you know, that they could talk to, get a story from. That's what reporters do. If you look back on the day of 9/11, there was none of that happening, Jim.
That is very curious, isn't it?
You know, you've got a mass evacuation of tens of thousands of people from a building. First of all, can you recall a single video where people are streaming out the doors, Jim?
Some descriptions of it, I think, maybe from some firemen. Who was it who went back into the building and then lost his life, I think?
That was Father Michael Judge.
Could have been, yeah.
But if you recall, you'll notice that there was there's not any video that we've been able to discover of any people coming out of the World Trade Center. Now, one of the things that they did to cover for this would be, you know, the jumpers. They played a dual role, the emotional element, you know, and everybody that's watching this unfold on TV, you know, faces that feeling and that empty feeling of seeing, you know, what's transpiring. But at the same time, it allowed the firemen to say, well, we're not going to evacuate out the front doors. We're going to evacuate these people, you know, through these exits. But still, the question remains, where's the reporters at the end of those tunnels? Wherever those people were allegedly coming out, we don't have a single exit interview of any of those people. Not one.
That seems rather extraordinary. You'd think reporters would be there trying to get them right and left. I mean, their story of their heroic escape from the burning tower.
Well, and as well, the story really is up where the impact zone is, and every reporter worth his salt should have been throwing his press pass around, doing everything he could to have climbed those stairs to get up there where the story was happening. Yet we haven't heard one story about a reporter who died trying to get the story. We surely haven't seen any photos or video taken by or of a reporter trying to get the story. You know, it's another example of the dog that doesn't bark on 9/11.
You know, one of the reasons I believe that we don't see streams and streams of people coming out the building is because there wasn't streams and streams of people to come out the building.
Yeah, that's right. That's the best explanation, if indeed that's the case. That's the best explanation. The simplest, you know, by far, yeah.
The simplest explanation, exactly.
Assuming it's consistent with all the other evidence, and of course your absence of all the toilets, desks, seat, chairs, computers, and all that is very, very impressive.
Now, if you go back to the radio thread, hopefully you still have it open, and take a look at that picture of Edna Cintron. For anybody that's tuning in, if you can go to letsroll911.info and scroll down to the second post where you see a picture of the plane imprint in the building.
Yep,
now,
I'm there.
Okay, take a good look at this picture, Jim. Analyze the picture and tell me we've all seen this picture a thousand times, but have you ever noticed that there's something peculiarly absent in this picture?
Well, I don't see any parts of any plane.
Okay.
I also don't see a lot of billowing smoke coming out, pouring out of the hole. I don't see fires in the background, apart from a little bit up at the top.
What else? Where's the floors?
Yeah, the plane actually intersect with 8 different floors.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no dented or chipped floors or gouged floors. Is what you see behind Edna Cintron is a huge black void.
Yeah, that is interesting because the plane was intersecting with 8 different floors. I show that in one of the slides on my PowerPoint that came from Killtown's website.
Now, if we go back to some of the testimony that we got from the gelatin team doing the B thing at the World Trade Center, they were on the 91st floor, and some of their notes, you know, cryptically said, only 10 missing floors to the top of the building. You know, we believe that they were talking about the empty gutted structure. Now, this picture backs up basically what Jellison was saying. In this picture, if the World Trade Center is as we were told, you would see the floors behind her. You know, there's at least 3 individual floors here that you would see, but none of them are present.
Well, as I said, actually diagrammatically, you can see the plane was intersecting with 8 different floors, and you'd certainly think that you would be seeing at least damaged parts of those floors. That's very peculiar, but I mean, you know, it boggles the mind to imagine that some of those trusses could have been removed. I mean, you couldn't even get anywhere in the building without the flooring actually being there.
Well, you could with scaffolding, you know, and however they set it up. I mean, the buildings, you know, and, you know, we personally believe that these buildings had been a long time being pre-demoed and were missing an awful lot of floors. And as you will see later on in the show, we have reason to believe that, you know, it might have been like this from the beginning. Or, you know, we're not sure. We're investigating this. It's kind of like an open investigation.
From the beginning? You mean from the time that they were opened in 1970?
Yeah. We're going to, you know, be getting into that in the second part of the show. But, you know, we're not sure what we're looking at here. We've seen some pictures during construction, post-construction, well after construction, that would indicate hollow towers, that there was large portions of these buildings that might never have been put in place to begin with, or they were taken down, you know, I mean, as they were putting floors in, they were taking them out almost as fast as they were putting them in.
Phil and Larry, we're going to take our first break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. My special guests today are Phil Jahan and Larry McWilliams, and we're talking about research they're doing on Twin Towers fakery, some of which is quite startling. If it's true, it creates a whole new way of looking at 9/11. We'll be right back.
Admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it? Who did it? The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
These are words that go together well.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Phil Jahand and Larry McWilliams about fakery at the Twin Towers involving the actual building itself, falling bodies, and a whole host of other assorted aspects of this issue. You guys are really into some terribly interesting stuff. And, Gad, I don't know, you know, where do you want to roll from here?
Well, one of our new discoveries is Mark Bingham.
Yeah.
And if, you know, for people just tuning in, if they could go to letsroll911.info, we've set up a thread where we're going to be going through the information. And underneath the Edna Cintron photo, do you see the Mark Bingham link?
I do. I'll click it.
If you could right-click on that and open that in a new window.
Uh-huh, I got it.
Now, Mark Bingham was, you know, one of the people that the whole 9/11 story hung on, and we can't forget that. He's one of the Let's Roll crew. This is one of the people from Flight 93 who banded together heroically, and come hell or high water, they were going to storm the cockpit and take back the plane from the Arab hijackers. And, you know, we know how the story ended. When, I believe during the Massawi trial, there was information coming out that basically showed that this saga never happened. And the LA Times printed a story basically retracting the story that the Let's Roll story never occurred to begin with. And, you know, it was quietly swept under the rug, you know, until now. When we were going through the pictures for the EXIF data, the IPTC data, it's digital data that's embedded inside each photograph, one of the things that it tells you is the picture being taken day. And the picture being taken day is the actual date the picture was taken, and later on if the picture is edited, like in this case, they put a white family photo AP sidebar on the side of the photograph, that EXIF data, the IPTC data, is changed to the last edit date. Now, what's interesting with Todd Bingham's photograph is, you know, it has the EXIF data of 8/30/2001. This is 13 days before 9/11, and this picture comes complete with the white sidebar that says family photograph, and embedded on the inside, as you'll see in the story below, is, you know, his whole bio and obituary.
Where do I find that?
If you scroll down to a snapshot of the September, you know, memorial, you'll see the picture of the him on the left and then the data on the right. This picture, you know, was taken on 8/30/2001. Well, it wasn't taken. This is his graduation picture, allegedly, from 1993.
Well, I see the graduation picture because he's, of course, wearing his cap. The memorial page. Hit the web archive. Is that what I should do?
Well, I mean, that's where we got this picture from. This is one of the pictures that was removed from the CNN Memorial website after we broke the John Wankus Mike Rivero story. About 2 weeks after we broke that story, CNN removed dozens, hundreds of pictures from the website, just all at once. And this is one of the pictures that was removed. We believe that they were removing it because of the digital data that's embedded inside the photograph.
Uh-huh.
Because basically, in a nutshell, let me say it like this. What we found inside the photograph proves the whole 9/11 story to be a lie, because this photograph was pre-prepared 2 weeks before 9/11, full and complete with its obituary.
I love it. I love it.
You want to pick up on that, Larry?
Yeah, and Jim, the picture with the EXIF data next to it is two pictures below that first cap and gown graduation photo. It kind of says Ember 11th, is what is cut off of the September 11th.
Well,
but you can actually see the EXIF data for yourself over there on the right-hand side, and you can see that it says file, Mark Bingham 31, et cetera, and so on. You can see that they have his a little bio and his obit.
Should I
right
click
there.
Click on United Flight 93? Is that where I should click?
No, it's right below that, photo that has United Flight 93. It's the section below it is the EXIF reader, has the EXIF reader next to his cap and gown photo. And you can look where it says caption, and that's what Phil has clicked in when he takes the screenshot. And then you can see In the bottom left of the EXIF reader, it says file, and it gives you this little obit. All of that was embedded in the photograph. And we can't forget that Mark Bingham was the gentleman who called his mother, Alice Hoagland, who was on every network news program within a few days of 9/11. She was in place and ready to go. And that, he was the gentleman who called his mother and said, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham."
I know.
And kept saying, "You do believe me, don't you? You do believe me."
I know, it's so absurd.
And again, you know, with exit data 2 weeks before, he just happens to be one of the prime players.
Now, talk about the video, too, of Alice Hoagland and her, husband, Mark's stepfather, Larry.
We of course, we found this. We dug up everything we could find from right after 9/11. And there's a very good Larry King interview with that couple. And, I would just urge your listeners to go to this thread and take a look at the YouTube of the Larry King interview. I don't think you have to be a Freudian analyst to listen to this lady's interview. This is 2 days after she's lost her son. And I would just urge the listeners to go to watch it and make their own judgment as to the genuineness of her demeanor. Her demeanor is extremely odd for a grieving mother 2 days after the loss of her son, especially in such an unexpected tragedy. She's laughing and it's all kind of matter of fact to her in an odd way. Her demeanor, in my opinion, is more like that of a nervous actress than it is a grieving mother, and I would postulate that that's because she was a nervous actor on Larry King.
Very strange.
Yeah, what's interesting, Jim, is these are the heroes. I mean, this is the frontline squad, and they've got errors inside the pictures that prove the whole story to be an incredible fraud. All you have to do is take these pictures, put them inside of an exit viewer, which is free, and you can see, the day the picture was taken or the day of the last edit. And this is the reason that they removed hundreds of these pictures from the memorial once we started going through them.
Had you already captured them? Had you already made copies?
Yeah, we've got most of them, and the few that we don't have, we're getting from the web archive. So there's most of them are still available. Thank God for the web archive.
Are you finding a pattern then that most of them were prepared in advance?
Well, some of the, you can definitely see the ones that weren't prepared in advance because they've got the, normal EXIF data, we're really not sure on a date, but, anything before 9/14 or 9/15, is really suspect, and anything after 9/15 is probably pretty normal. The day's events, transpired, they didn't, they weren't over till dark, so, September 11th is a scratch, and as a reporter working for CNN, MSNBC, one of these other big organizations, you've got emails that you have to send, you have to wait for people to respond to the emails. You're not going to have the phone numbers of the people's family where you can just call them right up, so there's going to be a delayed process. And for them to have gotten any of these pictures, like Todd Beamer, he's one of the other heroes on Flight 93. His exit date is 9/13. That's very suspect. For them to have been able to get a picture of Todd Beamer by 9/13, complete with his obituary and everything else, that's fast. There's another fellow that was on Flight 93. His name was Alan Beaven. He was an environmental lawyer, and his exit data reads 9/12/2001. That's impossible. For the very next day, for CNN to have retrieved this photograph and gotten it from the AP press, all inside of, 12 or 14 hours, and then prepared it and gotten it ready, it's just not believable. It couldn't have happened that fast. So the EXIF data, the IPTC data, embedded inside the photographs is really a huge smoking gun.
Where's the Mark Bingham data on the photograph? Is that under carefully prepared aliases or is it another link? I'd just like to see that if I can.
Oh, you don't have it open? If you go to the radio show,
Is it the top? Are you there? Are you there? Let's see. One, two.
Jim?
Yeah, I've lost you.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. If you go to underneath the Edna Cintron photograph, there's a link, Mark Bingham, United Flight 93 hero.
Right, I went to that one. I've done that, yeah.
And then scroll down until you get to the fourth picture.
The fourth picture is, for me, Mark Bingham's mom on television, MSNBC.
The fourth picture.
Yeah, the first one is him in a graduation gown and cap. Then there's a picture of him with his glasses. Then the next one after that is the three in a row of the MSNBC and the ABC. And
For some reason, the picture's not showing up. But, you know, I have a screenshot of it. If you refresh your screen, it'll probably show up. September 11th, the memorial. And I have a screenshot of, you know, the EXIF data. I'm not sure why that's not showing up. But you're still with us, right, Larry? Larry?
Do we lose Larry, too, huh?
Jim?
Yeah, I'm here. The
how close are we to a break?
Well, we would normally not take one for 15 minutes, but I can take one early. Do you want me to take an early break? This is Jim Fetzer, your host, taking an early break while we reconnect with Larry McWilliams and talking with Phil Jahan about a whole lot of fraudulent activities on 9/11. We'll be right back.
Executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln Limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. We have Larry McWilliams back with Phil Jahan, and we're talking about some of the exhibits they prepared for us. We're missing the one that has the digital data that impugns the photograph of Mark Bingham, showing it was all prepped in advance, which is extremely destructive of the official account. In fact, I would say that that by itself pulls the rug out from under what the government has told us about 9/11. It's that preposterous. You guys were mentioning how Mark's mom seemed real strange in her interviews. What about this one on MSNBC? It's 4 minutes and 44 seconds. Shall I play it and then we can talk about it?
Yeah, that would work out good.
Okay, let's try that. Let's see what happens here. It's loading. I think we'll hear it. Mark Bingham incapable of answering the question, who are they?
One thing I might add while we're waiting.
No. I'm playing it. You don't hear him?
Oh.
You don't hear it?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, it went out just then.
Yeah, I don't hear it either. We don't hear your music either when you break.
You don't hear it. You didn't hear it at all. Okay, we'll talk about it a bit. Now I'll switch to Chris Matthews. Oh, here she is. Again.
Try hitting refresh too, Jim.
Can you hear her?
No.
Okay. Okay, it's too faint. Okay, it was too faint. It wasn't coming through. I thought it would come through on the air, but obviously it was very, very faint. I could see from the volume level. I could hear it very well, but you guys couldn't, and therefore our audience couldn't hear it either. So, but she does seem pretty cheerful, doesn't she? Sort of chipper about this whole thing.
Quite a lot.
It's just strange. It's just not natural. You know, you can look through this. You know, if that's all you had to rely on, you know, you could make a decent story for it. But with everything else that we found out about, you know, Mark Bingham, the whole story goes down the drain with the exit date on that photograph. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Jim? I mean, that photograph, the last time it was edited, as far as we can tell, is 8/30/2001.
8/30/2001. So we're talking about 12 days or so before the events of 9/11. And, of course, it wouldn't have been known that they would need an obituary on the guy until after he's dead, which occurs, according to the official account, on 9/11 when the plane, Flight 93, crashes in Shanksville. And yet they've got an obituary already prepared. I mean, this is a relatively young guy. He's only 31 years old.
Well, the obituary also says that he died in the crash at Shanksville.
And you got an obituary that was prepared before 9/11 that says he died in the crash in Shanksville. That's
correct.
That is fantastic. Wait, can I access that here somewhere?
Try refreshing the page. I just uploaded the same image on Photoshop, and you know maybe it'll show up for everybody now. I'm not sure why it didn't
okay,
show before.
Okay. Okay, let's see what we got here. I've refreshed. Oh, yeah, now there's something here. The September Memorial.
Yeah, right. That's it.
All right, yeah, now it's there. Okay, and what should be looking at?
If you notice the blue highlighted area, there's a dark blue highlight, and then below that there's a light blue highlight. The last line of the light blue highlight is taking a picture day. Do you see that?
No, I got the dark blue line, but I don't have the...
Yeah, well, you just have to look for it. It's hard to see.
You have a dark blue line, then you have one line of data in white, and then a light blue area that's highlighted below it.
For the next...
Oh, caption? Oh,
right.
Okay. It's not showing up colorized here, but it is darker. Okay, subtitle, Bingham. Let's see...
Go down to...
Oh, it says 2001-08/30.
That's it.
And you notice in the left-hand lower corner of the EXIF reader screenshot, the caption.
File, Mark Bingham, 31, shown in this 1983 graduation photograph from the University of... Is it California? Berkeley?
Yes.
Was killed aboard United Flight 93 from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco Tuesday, September 11, 2001, after a crash outside of it, I suppose Shanksville is the word I can't read. Well, that's pretty stunning.
Well, you know what's interesting about this, Jim, is we can definitely say this. We can say that there was no edits done to this photograph after 8/30, 2001.
Yeah.
So you have to ask yourself, when did that white sidebar family photograph get put on? That's, you know, in our opinion, that's what changes the exit date on the photograph. That's what changes the picture being taken day, is when you actually edit the photograph. I don't think that it changes it when you put in the obituary, but when you actually edit the photograph like they did to put in that white sidebar on the side that says family photo, AP Press, that's the new picture being taken day.
Where was this old bit published?
Well, this would have been published sometime after 9/11.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Do you know where it was published?
That's the AP photo that would have gone out on any AP story. So any AP obit for in any story, including Mark Bingham, would have used that obit.
Yeah, I see the sidebar where it says family photograph vertically.
Now, had they put in that white sidebar on 9/16, you know,
yeah,
that's when the picture would say 9/16 instead of 8/30.
Boy, I tell you, that's really something. You just may have something here that's a real winner. This is really bizarre.
Now, the lady that we talked about last week, we mentioned Sonia Morales Puopolos, P-U-O-P-O-L-O-S, Puopolos. The exit date on her photograph, I don't think that we mentioned this last week, is, I believe it's 313 or 413-2001.
Right.
So, you know,
you're telling me they were prepping and putting together these obits and all this long in advance of 9/11, long in advance.
Absolutely, and all the friends of the network, you know, that, you know, were going to be willing players, you know, people needing new identities for whatever reason, you know, could get aboard. And apparently, I mean, you know, look at Sonia Morales Puopolos. She had Kerry and Clinton show up at her funeral. I mean, it's not hard to figure out where, you know, they got her from. People ask about the victims. They ask about the passengers. What about the passengers? This answers the question. They were friends of the network. You know, some of them were real. Some of them were fictions. Some of them were facial morphs. Some of them were people that were already dead. Some people were people that were probably dying and going to die soon, but they could go out in the ball of glory and have all sorts of neat things written about them in a newspaper.
This is a doozy.
Yeah, Mark Bingham, this.
Now, of course, this is, you're suggesting similar things were done at the Twin Towers that were done here with the airline passengers aboard, for example, here in Flight 93.
Well, absolutely. Last week we spoke about David Rice. David H. Rice, somebody that was on the 104th Tower, he supposedly worked for Stanley O'Neill and Company. And the exit date on David H. Rice's picture, you know, complete with the obituary, is 9/11/01. They wouldn't know who died on the towers on 9/11/01.
Yes, I mean, of course. Too soon. I mean,
but to go through proper notification of family and go through all of the procedures which would have been followed had it been a real disaster killing all these people, there's no conceivable way they could have contacted the family and received, first of all, ascertained that he was dead, contacted the family, received a family photo, and had all of this together on the day of 9/11.
Oh, I agree completely.
Now, we were going to have a little bit of fun with you tonight, and the radio listeners, for the next person that we were going to unveil. Her name is Barbara Restigoy. And we were going to be making a phone call. You know, we tracked down her old numbers, Jim.
Yeah.
Barbara Restigoy was a flight attendant, allegedly on Flight 11. And she wasn't supposed to fly that day, but she was called in. She's one of those. There was about 50% of all the flight attendants that have that same story. They weren't scheduled, but they flew. And Barbara Restigoy, we tracked down her phone number through a pay search. And, you know, where you pay $1.99, and yeah, you know, you get the number. And we know that it was her number because her birthday was right next to the number.
Okay.
You know, to verify it. So, you know, we were curious. There was two numbers. They both were the same number, but, you know, with different area codes. One was 508, one was 703. And so we called the number, and the number was 703-428-0902. In case anybody wants to write this down, 703-428-0902. We gave her a call, and what we got on the other line was, Air Force 8, how may I help you?
Air Force 8?
Yeah, and you know, I'm like, excuse me, are you at 2500 Van Dorn? Because that's what her address was. And he says, no, we're at the Pentagon. And I says, okay, you know, I have the wrong number. So, you know, we hung up and, you know, I told a couple of people about that and, you know, shared the number. And a few people called and, you know, got the same response. And we called the number today before the show because we were going to do this live on the air and give them a call. You know, this is Barbara Restigoy's number. You call her old number and it goes back to the Pentagon, Air Force Aid. So what's really interesting is as we started investigating Barbara a little bit more, we discovered the addresses that were given in her profiles, her and her boyfriend, was it her boyfriend? Fiance. Both addresses is nothing but an empty lot of woods between houses.
Really?
Okay,
really?
I mean,
in Marston's Mill, Massachusetts, with Wayne Nichols?
Correct. Yeah.
She lived in an empty lot, huh?
Right between two really nice houses, though.
Maybe they camped out, huh? She doesn't look like the camping type to me, but...
And it's nearly impossible. You know, you say, well, Larry, you could have the wrong Barbara Arestigue, but
that's not a very common, a very
unique name, and as well as Phil pointed out, her birthday is right next. I mean, her birthday is right there. There's no mistake, unless there were two Barbara Arestigues born on the same date.
So my inference would be that they forgot to change the number that was being used to call the Pentagon to fake Barbara Arestigue on 9/11 or whatever.
Correct. Should anybody check the thin backstory, they had it going to the right place, Air Force Age, so that somebody would be ready. Oh, that number's ringing. But unfortunately, after all the years passed, I guess they completely... Just to back it up, we did. I made the phone call, as well as we put it up in chat, and at least a half a dozen people made the phone call as well.
And that's why it's no longer working, of course. They realized you were onto something.
Yeah, we were surprised. We were disappointed today when we called. You know, we were just going to call and make sure that it was still working and do it on the show, because it's a real eye-opener. You know, you call a Barbara Arestigue's old number that she had that they listed for her, and it goes back to the Pentagon. It shows you a very thin backstory for, I would say, a not very carefully prepared alias at all.
And not only that, but she's listed as living in Massachusetts, yet again, you know, the area code is the D.C. area code that takes you to the Pentagon, so.
Yeah, it's actually in Virginia, I think. It's in Arlington.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that is a doozy, too. And what do we know about her? Is she in the Social Security Death Index?
You know, we haven't put up a profile on her yet. We've probably got one in private chat somewhere. I can check those things while we do the show, and I'll have them back for you in a few minutes. But in the meantime, with Barbara Arestigue, we haven't been able to really Julia from the forums, another forum member. She was working on Barbara Arestigue, and the last, work that she was doing, we were trying to verify Wayne Nichols as a doctor. I believe in Massachusetts it says that he was. And she couldn't find any records for, Wayne Nichols, Dr. Wayne Nichols, in the state that he was supposed to live in.
I love it.
And practice in. So, you put that together with, her addresses showing up between, in an empty lot, empty wooded lot. Her phone number going back to the Pentagon, the fact that flight 11 never hit the first tower, and that it also didn't even fly that day according to the BTS database, the two American flights, 11 and 77. You put this all together, and basically it leads you to the point that the passengers were
fabrications. Right. Yeah.
And there's Larry's come up with about 8 different categories that we found them in. And
thanks to Jim Fetzer, because he asked me the question on the last time we were on, how did they come up with these? So I was caught just a little bit off guard, and I answered it incompletely. So I went ahead and thought for a minute. I came up with a few categories, and then people helped me on the forums add a few, and I think we pretty well have it covered. If you don't mind, I'll get to you just very quickly.
Yeah, I wish you would. That's great. Yeah, go for it.
Number one, complete fakes, Operation Northwood-style total fictions, which would be Barbara Arestigue.
Okay.
Fake relatives of real operatives, that is, made-up aliases added to the family of spooks and insiders so that the spook relatives could play roles conducive to backing up the lie. So, you know, somebody who never existed, but the family, their fake family exists. We just add a name to their family, and he was, you know, their son, brother.
Have you got an illustration of that one too?
We have several
of those.
Mark,
is Mark Bingham in that category, or is he?
I would think that Mark Bingham would fall into that category, wouldn't you? And then number three, real people who are spooks, essentially reassigned. That is, people who are deep cover agents who put on the list to neatly end their service or assignment, and you know, and would leave no trail, and nobody would be looking for them because, of course, they're dead. Number four, real people who are connected, like Sonia Puopolo, people who are connected and possibly wanted a new lease on life, start over, disappear for various reasons. Real people in trouble who were voluntarily reassigned, you know, so people where they come and say, look, like in the Vietnam era when they said you can go to jail or you can go to Vietnam, look, we can prosecute you or you can help us out with this little operation we have going on, and added them to the list. Number six, real people in trouble who are coerced. It's almost the same thing, but just a little bit different. Real people connected who are terminally ill, as Phil mentioned earlier. Why just die when you can go out as a 9/11 hero, add you to the list, and off you go. Number eight, real people who are long dead. We found many people whose names show up in the Social Security Death Index at a date prior to 9/11, and appear to be very close to the same people, you know, maybe 6 months before, a year before, sometimes 2 years before. So they just added them to the list. They had a convenient story and added it to the list. Number nine, real people who were intentionally murdered, you know, beforehand possibly, and then they just put the name on the list to cover it up. You know, if they had people on a list that they needed to do away with, what better way to do it? If they were in Boston or New York, or would then to do away with them, then add them to the 9/11 list. There would never be an investigation, et cetera, and so on. Number 10, real people intentionally murdered who may have been purposely sacrificed during the demolition. Some people believe that John O'Neill would fall in this category. Number 11, and final, real people who were accidental victims, the unintended collateral damage that we believe the three real birth certificates that were issued may very well have been. So that's 11 possible categories of ways that we could Northwoods up these victims. And also the beauty of using all of these different ways, if they had all been Northwoods fakes, it would have been very easy to track, and you know, the pattern would have been consistent and identifiable. When you use all these different types of fake victims, you really do throw anybody who's investigating off the trail, because as soon as they think they've established a pattern, well, they'll find one that doesn't fit the pattern.
Oh, I think this is excellent.
Yeah, and per your question earlier, Jim, she's not in the Victims Compensation Fund, Barbara Rustigoy, and she is also not in the Social Security Death Index, although there is four other Rustigoys in the index. One has a death in 1999, there's two others with 2003, and then one in 2007 that died. So, and they're all pretty elderly.
Very good. Very good.
82. So, you know, when you start looking, this is easy stuff. When you start investigating the passengers and just start doing simple searches, you uncover major damning material on the official story. And what's amazing is that we've all overlooked all this investigation, you know, for almost 9 years now.
Well, there's a reason for that, because it's nearly taboo in our society. And emotionally, we identified with these people as dead on 9/11. And in a sense, we really had to step across the threshold of the whole taboo of speaking ill of the dead, thinking ill of the dead that we have in our society, to even allow our minds to start asking these questions. And that's a major part of the big lie. And part of the reason we were never expected to see this, I don't believe, because I don't believe they thought anybody would psychologically break that barrier to say, well, just wait a minute. maybe these aren't heroes at all.
Yeah, which really kind of leads us to the next subject that we wanted to cover. And, you know, that's the 9/11 Memorial Law. Why don't you start out with that, Larry? You've done, you know, more of the recent work on that.
Well, I wrote a thread, and Phil started it, and we kind of filled it in. We had the idea, first of all, if we just apply a little bit of critical thinking to the, you're aware of the victims' memorial wall, the missing, I call them the lost dog posters, the wall of posters. Have you seen my relative who was in the World Trade Center? You're familiar with
that? No, actually, I'm not.
Jim.
You tell me about it. This is all great, great stuff.
There was a huge wall near the ground zero, where presumably, as the story is told, hundreds and indeed thousands of families came and put up posters with photographs of their missing relatives from 9/11, with a phone number saying, "Have you seen this person?"
Hey, Larry, before you go on, for the radio listeners out there, if they could go to letsroll911.info and scroll to the second post. Underneath the picture of Barbara Restigo, you'll see a link that says 9/11 Victims Memorial Wall in New York City.
Yeah, was it a good. That's what I was looking for myself. Very good.
Yeah,
right.
Open that window and then go ahead. You know,
yeah.
Continue, Larry.
I see it.
Terrific.
Now.
Then you can see the posters that we're talking about, and you can see how many there were. First of all, if we apply just a little bit of critical thinking to this, if you lost a relative on Tuesday at the World Trade Center, you would be in the emergency rooms. You would be ringing City Hall's hook. You would be calling the morgue. You would be doing a lot of things. But one thing you probably wouldn't be doing would be taking your relative's picture and posting up downtown. You know, if you just think about it for a moment, what would these families be expecting? They'd be expecting their relative to be zombified, wandering around lower Manhattan, and somebody to identify them from one of these photographs and direct them to their home or call and say, you know, it, almost like a lost dog.
I mean, really, I mean, what do they expect? I mean, are they expecting that their lost loved ones are wandering around covered in dust and blood, banging off the walls of the high-rise buildings, and they're going to continue doing that until they put up a missing poster and somebody sees it and says, "Oh, that person covered with dust and blood, they're from the World Trade Center."
You're supposed to hose them off and then compare them with the photos on the wall.
Right. So, you know, it's fairly ridiculous in a single case, much less that thousands of people would be doing the same thing, you know, expecting their relatives to be wandering around lost or unidentifiable. You know, this type of amnesia that I believe is reserved to daytime soap operas. But the other thing that's interesting, the victim's wall, is the New York Times, and we'll get into the portraits of grief later, but the New York Times developed their list by supposedly taking these posters down, and they claim, the CNN Memorial claims, and that many of the photographs in the CNN Memorial were such poor photographs because, indeed, they were scanned from these weathered posters which had been on the streets of New York. Now, this makes sense not at all. For one thing, if you look at the exit data on some of these CNN Memorial pictures, you'll see that it includes the picture that the memorial photo was cropped from, and many of them, indeed, are cropped from these posters. Yet, you know, right there on the cross, there's a phone number. Why wouldn't you dial a phone number and get a better picture than this terrible picture that's been rained on, was a print, and then you've scanned it, and they're almost unrecognizable. There are so many things about this wall that make absolutely no sense whatsoever when any scrutiny is applied, you know, just the slightest bit of critical thinking. It really makes no sense. The only way it does make sense is that if you had 2,800 completely fake victims, what you would be missing is 2,800 families looking for them. This was a way. This wall, by the way, sprung up 2 days after 9/11. These photos of all of these posters are 2 and 3 days after 9/11. What these posters did, though, is create for the viewer all of these families that are looking for their loved ones, which you did not see anywhere. They weren't in the emergency rooms. They weren't at Mayor Giuliani's speeches trying to find out what the official list would be. There weren't 2,800 screaming families. But these posters in the PSYOP were designed essentially to represent those for us, and they were covered on all the major news networks after 9/11, essentially to plant in our mind that there were indeed families looking for these missing people.
You know, what's interesting to that, too, is if you look at, like, Lucy Fishman, you know, her picture in the CNN Memorial, we have the exif data in that thread, the 9/11 Victims Memorial Wall in New York City. If you look at the, you know, the picture that they took, you can see the poster that it was cropped from in the exif data, okay? And there is a phone number. You know, how does a CNN reporter know that this person's dead? I mean, it's mandatory that you call that phone number to, you know, confirm whether they're alive or dead, first of all. And then after you confirm that they're dead, you know, then, you know, how about a better picture?
Yeah, maybe the poster was successful and somebody found them and sent them home so that, in fact, although they're, I mean, their poster and number is still there, but that doesn't mean they're dead. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, they could have just, you know, been missing for a few days. This does happen.
This is just incredible.
Oh, you want to see something really incredible? You scroll down to this 1, 2, 3, 4, underneath the exif data. If you look at the picture where you can see the tape around the pictures, Larry noticed this.
So, you know, so many of them are done with the same extra wide tape.
Yeah.
Yep. So they just happened, all of the victims' families happened to have the same roll of extra wide packing tape available to put something up on a brick wall. And just all happened to have it, you know, identical at the same time.
Some of them have packing tape. Some's blue, some's red, some's brown. But
right.
And now
the vast majority seem to be put up using a similar technique with this extra wide tape.
And we would postulate that that's because, again, this wall was put up, you know, in the night, put up to serve a very important purpose, to plant in our minds death and destruction on 9/11.
Yeah, the PSYOP aspect of this is really fascinating. I'd like you guys, one of you, to read the four paragraphs, you know, about the... There are many incredulous things about this 9/11 Victims Memorial Wall of which everyone should be aware, and then you have those four paragraphs. Could one of you read that? Read those four paragraphs? I think they're important.
Yeah, well, I'll take the first two, and Larry can take the last two.
There you go.
First, the posters went up in the first 2 days after 9/11. Most of them were missing posters. If you see so-and-so, please call.
Missing person posters, yeah.
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. If you see so-and-so, please call. This is not even likely, much less believable. Most of the people who allegedly worked at the World Trade Center did not live anywhere close to it. Secondly, if your wife or sister worked at the World Trade Center and didn't come home, are you going to spend your time calling hospitals and morgues, or are you going to put up a missing poster? As if your wife or mother might be bruised, bloodied, and injured, covered in dust, bumping around in the walls of New York City, just waiting for someone who has seen one of your missing posters to rescue you. Many of the posters were put up using the same extra-wide scotch tape or packing tape. If the memorial wall were real, made by the victims' families, there would be all sorts of different tape used to attach the posters to the wall. Hundreds of different people are not going to bring the same type of tape for their missing 9/11 victims' posters. Larry?
Many of these missing posters, which presumably had phone numbers on them for easy contact in case their loved ones were found wandering the streets of the city, ended up being used for the official 9/11 CNN Memorial website. Why use these awful pictures of a poster, which is weathered and warped, when their phone number of a family member is right there to call for a picture, and better yet, a story? It appears that the 9/11 Victims Memorial Wall was put up not by grieving families missing their loved ones, but another group of people trying to actually prove the existence of these missing people from 9/11. It also appears this was a cheap attempt to kill two birds with one stone, as they also used the wall in a cynical attempt to degrade the people's photographs and images even further by taking third-generation photographs of the people listed on the wall from a video camera, making the people's images almost unrecognizable. This would normally be considered sacrilege. Nobody would relative to be memorialized by one of these awful, horrible pictures. But what if there were indeed morphs or fabrications of some kind using whatever technique, a good way to hide the Photoshop effects, the pixelation effects, anything that you might have done to alter photographs to create them would certainly be covered up by the copy scan process. These pictures would be muddied up so much that nobody could say, hey, that was Photoshopped, because it's so awful to begin with.
I'll bet you somebody got a promotion for coming up with this idea of a 9/11 victims wall.
Absolutely.
Somebody got a promotion and a bonus.
It was very effective, Jim. And again, once the idea is created in our mind, we have a very difficult time, especially since it is death and a taboo, we have a very difficult time climbing over that and asking questions.
Yes, I agree completely. You know, this is the whole business about, you know, by challenging the official account, you're supposed to be disrespecting the lives of those who died, when in fact, nothing could be a higher form of respect than to determine how and why they died. I mean, it's a completely ridiculous gambit.
A moderator on our forum pointed out the same thing. If you had perished, would you not want people to investigate to the very last end of the earth to find out what happened? Of course you would. Most certainly. The other thing about the victims' memorial wall is that CNN, you know, who essentially at 9/11 was the official list maker. There is no official list of dead from 9/11 published anywhere except from CNN. And they always have the out that they use these posters.
This is so unbelievably clever. You create this victim's wall, and then you have it as the source for the purported victims, and the whole thing is rigged from the beginning.
Right, very circular and neat, is it not?
Beautiful. Very self-justifying. Beautiful.
Correct.
Very clever.
The other thing about the wall is that the New York Times published a series every day in the newspaper starting in September, and it ran through December of 2001, called Portraits of Grief. And you've seen them if you've read anything on passengers, because usually the only bio available is these portraits of grief done by the New York Times. Several very odd things about them. They're not biographies at all. Each of them is purely finds a human interest angle. Their hobby, their pets, they were nice to their nieces and nephews, instead of, what they did for a living and things like that. The odd things about the portraits of grief is, first and foremost, they have no byline. Reporters from all over the paper, business reporters, sports reporters, everybody got their turn in the pool, took these victims' posters, called the numbers on them, talked to the family who acquired these stories, and then they were published. Not one of them has a byline of a reporter on it. Sometimes at the end of the morning's Portraits of Grief, where there'd be five or six a day, it would list some of the reporters in the pool, but the stories are not attributed to anybody. And, if you know anything about newspapers, especially at the level of the New York Times, reporters, if they're going to investigate a story, especially if something as important as 9/11 was in 2001, if they're going to take the time to talk to a relative, they're going to write a story, it absolutely is going to have their name on it.
Yeah,
and these stories don't. They're pure, they're bull is what they are. If you start reading them, it doesn't take long to establish that there were three or four templates used, clearly, because they start to ring. I could probably write 100 of them tomorrow you know, because I've read them so much, I know the templates. They're complete fakes. They're staged completely. Plus, no New York Times writer, much less the entire staff, is going to write a bunch of stories and not have their name on it at all. There is a book published, Portraits of Grief, which you can purchase, which contains all of the portraits of grief.
Really?
Or you can, absolutely.
Or you can look them up on the New York Times. All this stuff that you're talking about here, the victim's wall, is all in this Portraits of Grief book?
Right. They explain that that's how they came up with the Portraits of Grief, which, like I said, is about the only information released on most of these victims, be they passengers or World Trade Center victims.
Notice how cleverly this circumvents all the laws about certification of death and, you know, burial and all that kind of stuff. I mean, this is really a clever, incredibly clever ruse. Assuming, you know, I'm finding your arguments very persuasive that this is a form of fakery, and it's very, very clever.
Well, the fact that it went up, I mean, the very day after 9/11 and then the next day, within 2 days, I mean, that's really the thing that makes it most suspicious. I mean, people aren't going to put up missing posters for their loved ones. They're either coming home or they're at a hospital. Or they're not coming home. It's one of those three things. It's not like they're lost at ground zero.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, you guys, we've had our long segment, and we're caught up now. We're going to take our final break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, a return engagement from Phil Jahan and Larry McWilliams. We'll be right back.
Cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darrow. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, J. Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing, actually completing my conversation for today with Larry McWilliams and Phil Jahan. And I got to say, guys, you're really doing a great job of blowing me away. This stuff about the victim's wall and the 11 categories, all that stuff is sensational. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. You know, what's even more exciting, Jim, is it seems like this message is just meant to resonate. Everyone that we've, you know, shared this, we've received virtually no opposition, and people look at it, and most people at this time, they're worn out by 9/11, and we still really haven't gotten to the truth of what happened that day. And for the most part, we think this answers just about, you know, all the questions that remain.
Yeah, the one point I had left over from our first interview was when you were talking about the bodies coming down, and that one or another of them seemed to continue moving after hitting the ground, and you were suggesting it could be mechanized. But I think that anything that were mechanized would be, you know, blown apart when it hit the ground. I mean, I think that kind of fakery would be exposed, so there may be an alternative explanation. Though it's possible, to me, that some of the bodies may be persons who are already deceased that were given a heave-ho out the window.
Oh, absolutely. We're not really sure on you know, exactly the mode, you know, and exactly what was thrown out the window. It's possible that dummy that keeps moving after it hits the ground, I mean, it's possible it was made in Japan and it was just a little higher quality.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is you fall, you know, 80 floors or whatnot, you're going to be splattered all over the place. If you're some kind of mechanism, you're not going to remain intact.
Yeah, well, the same thing applies with the person. It's not just that somebody's going to die. There's going to be a complete blowout of their system, not just a blowout of blood pressure because all their blood's going to be blown out, literally blown out, but their entire all their organs are going to be disconnected from the walls, and I mean, there's going to be no movement in any of those bodies. I know that people can argue otherwise, But when somebody falls 90 floors and hits the pavement,
right?
Okay, that's the last they're moving.
Right. I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that, but that's the only issue that I have has occurred to me residual from the last, you know, our last talk about where you're showing the photographs of the inside of the tower where it was missing the ceiling fixtures and all of that. I mean, this is really astounding. I mean, if you guys are on the right track, and it's hard to see how you're not, it's shedding an entirely new light on 9/11. I mean, from a completely unexpected direction.
Well, what we found, Jim, is after we've gotten into this, it's caused us, and hopefully it will everyone else eventually, to back up to square one, really, and start all over again to look at everything that we've been studying for the last 9 years in a new light. And as we've done it, it really has helped us even with this, because things start to make so much sense. And as we look back, we continue to see things like the wall. But, you know, the wall was innocuous when we saw it in 2001. Now it's just plain as day. And so many things. And really, we're starting anew. We really are starting anew with 9/11. And it really has energized, like Phil said, a lot of people have to see enthusiasm was really gone to a great extent. And here, now there's a reason to go back through 9 years of research and look at it with a different set of glasses on.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, I wanted to take a second and, you know, thank some of the people at the forum, but, you know, because all this work that we've done, you know, it wouldn't have been possible without them. You know, there's
thank Von Zolta,
there's Clive, iScribe, Together We Stand, that's Kelly, Phasmatis, Kevin, then, you know, McCleric, you know, you said that she's one of your favorites, Claire?
Yeah.
You know, she's been on your show before.
Yes, Claire's terrific.
But, you know, where we kind of like to end up the show today is, you know, Clive found a new photograph of, you know, we had been looking at a photograph of the towers under construction last week. And for anybody who's just tuning into the show, if they could go to letsroll911.info and scroll down to the second post until you get to a beautiful shot of the towers in a pinkish-purple sunset.
This is below Barbara Arestigetti or whatever.
Yeah, below Barbara Arestigoy.
Arestigoy.
You see the picture, Jim?
Yeah, I sure do.
Good, this one's showing up. Clive found this last week, and Larry and I were so excited when he had found this, because if you look at the picture underneath it, we had discovered, well, this picture, we didn't discover the picture, I was well aware of the picture for a long time, but this is a picture of the World Trade Center under construction.
Right.
Now, you know, we're not sure what to do with this, you know, we're not making any hard claims here, because we're not really sure what to do with these pictures, Jim, but you take a look at the North Tower there, and does that look like a completed, finished building to you, or does it look like there's maybe 60 floors missing?
Which are you talking about?
The orange picture.
The orange picture, yeah.
And if you look, you know, at the left building, which is the North Tower.
No. It looks incomplete. I mean, I assume the floors are in there, you know, I assume the floors are in there, but it's strange. You'd think it would look more like sort of toward the bottom there of that midsection, you know, toward the bottom, you sort of see what almost look like horizontal lines. You see what I'm talking about? You see those lines? And then they discontinue. You don't see the lines continuing all the way up. You'd expect they would continue all the way up. Now, it could have to do with the sun and, you know, reflection and who knows what, but it does look odd. It does look odd.
And those were our reservations with the initial picture as well, the things you just pointed out.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the South Tower, the building to the right, you'll notice it looks like from around 60 to 75 looks incomplete as well.
Right, sure.
Now, these buildings were supposed to be, you know, one floor at a time, you know, cap, you know, one floor, you know, all the way up to the top, and then they put the caps on the buildings, and they were done. Now, Claire, the person that's been on your show before, she found a witness, a friend of the family or somebody that she knows, who was on a tour in the World Trade Center when they were 7 or 8 years old. And one of the things that she said that this person saw when they were there, they were allowed to go into parts of the building that the regular tour wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
And he said that he saw empty floor pans with no cement, and he said that he also saw a huge void inside one of the towers, you know, where there was no floors.
Really? When was that?
Yeah.
What year was that?
Well, he was 8 years old, Larry, when he went on
right.
the tour. So we know that he's at least 17 right now.
Oh, so it would have been like 9 or 10 years ago?
Well, we're not sure. It could have been in 1997. It could have been in 1986.
So my point being, sure. It's long after the tower's occupancy began in 1970.
Yeah, we're not sure exactly when the tour was. I think it was after the buildings were built. I think it was shortly after they were built, if memory serves. We're trying to track this person down so that we can, you know, get some more testimony. But it is interesting that as we go down these roads of investigation, we're finding more things to confirm this and absolutely zero things to deny any of this. You know, if you scroll back up to the picture that Clive found, the pinkish one, what's unusual about this is now we have the South Tower with the same issues that the North Tower has in the picture below. You see sections of the South Tower that apparently were never completed.
Well, what baffles me is the distribution of light in the buildings. I mean, you'd think it would be randomly lit up all over the place.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that we're doing to try to prove this, we're reasonably certain that these buildings were never completed, that there was, you know, 10 million square feet of space never came online all at the same time. One of the things that we're doing to try to prove this, and we could use anybody out there, any of the listeners that might be able to help with this, is we're looking at the real estate industry in New York City, trying to see if there was any displaced, you know, large amounts of displaced real estate when these buildings came online. Because that's what should have happened. This should have decimated the New York City commercial real estate market. You know,
yep.
government-built, government-run buildings, you know, going up with 10 million square feet of space. Jim, I mean, this would have decimated the commercial real estate market in New York City.
If I owned commercial real estate in New York City and the city was going to go in competition with me and roughly double the amount of space available and therefore by supply and demand, the city would essentially be undercutting my business, I certainly would have had to have been screaming as loud as I could scream, wouldn't
you? Well, you know, the owners of the Empire State Building were so upset at the prospect of having all this competition that they actually lodged a lawsuit. This was before the construction even began, so this would have been in the early 1960s, since construction began in 1966, claiming that the designs were unsafe, which led to a review of all of the designs for the World Trade Center and a vindication of their architecture and engineering, of course. But there were, you know, concerns of the very kind you are articulating by other major real estate owners, including of the Empire State Building.
Right. And certainly there should be records which show a sharp decline in the cost per square foot of office space in New York City. And you know, if for those of us that are old like I am, I remember Gerald Ford bailing New York City out not too far from this time frame. And New York was suffering from urban flight and was in bad financial condition. And then here they are going in direct competition with the private real estate market. That, it's another thing that really, in a lot of ways, makes no sense whatsoever. So I guess the point we're making is maybe all of that space never really did come online. And certainly not all at once, because it would have had such a decimating effect to the market.
Well, I can certainly envision having open floors that were unoccupied. I cannot envision having no floors at all. In other words, you know, they're putting them up one floor at a time. You had these trusses filled with 4 inches of concrete. I don't think there's any way in the world those buildings could have been constructed without having every floor in place. Now, I reiterate, that doesn't mean that they were all occupied. Maybe they were never all occupied.
Consider the Space Needle in Seattle. This would be, you know, similar to the Space Needle, except with the shell. You know, you have the Space Needle that has a central core, and it has no exterior core whatsoever. The central core and the exterior core are the same. And, you know, straight up to the top, you know, that's kind of, you know, what these pictures are leading us to believe. Like I said, you know, we're not hard set on anything with these pictures, but these pictures do seem to reveal some inconsistencies in what we were told about these buildings and how they were built. We've looked at these pictures, and we can come to no other conclusion than that these pictures show that these buildings are lacking large amounts of the floors.
Well, one thing, Jim, that Phil failed to mention about the bluish pink, the blue pink purple photo that Clive found last week is that photo is from 1978.
Oh, really?
Yes.
1978.
That puts it in a different light, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is all fascinating. I'll bet you're going to find photos of the Twin Towers taken every year, probably every month, maybe every day of their existence. I think you're going to be able to do a whole lot more in terms of putting together a sequence across time. I mean, these were such landmarks. These were such objects of fascination to tourists.
Well, now you said something that's really important. You know, a lot of people out there might have a hard time conceptualizing the idea that large portions of these towers didn't have tenants like we were told, and that at the end there was no tenants whatsoever. That, you know, people would say, well, what about the traffic? You know, where's all the foot traffic? You know, inside the buildings at the bottom, you know, they were both fed by their own subway. And people, you know, use the subways at the World Trade Center, whether they work there or not. Between the subways and the sky lobby and the observation deck in the other tower, you know, they had something at the top of each tower to guarantee traffic.
You know, windows on the world.
Yeah, you had 180,000 people a day that used the subways and, you know, windows of the world and the sky lobby. So without any tenants whatsoever, those buildings are packed, Jim.
Even without tenants, they would be packed.
There would be the appearance of a great deal of traffic, whether or not anybody went to work there or not. And we might mention also that neither the observation deck nor the stores nor the windows on the world was yet open at 9:30 in the morning on September 11th. Of course, those things opened later. So conveniently, none of those people would have been there to evacuate either.
Now, we received a video of the World Trade Center after it opened. Somebody put it up last week, and it's incredible. I mean, there's people everywhere. All the escalators are jammed. They're packed. There's people everywhere. I mean, you can't even find an empty spot, Jim. And then we have a video of the World Trade Center 1 week before 9/11 that somebody put up online. And you look at the video, Jim, everything is a ghost town. Everything is dead. There's nobody on the escalators. They show the tubes going down to that normally feed the subway. There's one person in the tube, Jim. You know, and it's between the hours of 3:30 and 6:30.
And when was this taken?
1 week before 9/11.
1 week before 9/11.
And when I watched it, as the time progressed, I kept waiting for, well, rush hour is certainly about to start. Well, rush hour is certainly about to start. It went 4:30. It went 5 o'clock. It went 5:15. It became 5:45. Never. Traffic coming into the building increased after rush hour. I guess people going into shop from wherever they were coming from or going, as Phil said, to get on the subway. But one would expect at 5 o'clock, World Trade Center a week before 9/11, one would have expected just a horde of people trying to get out of there and leave work. I mean, there should have been a mass stampede that simply is not there.
Fascinating. What day of the week was that?
I wish we knew. It just says 1 week before 9/11. We tried contacting. We haven't gotten a reply back yet.
9/11 was a Tuesday. 1 week
Correct.
Before 9/11 would be Tuesday, presumably.
Right.
Huh.
You know, if you we'll send you the video. We'll put it up in this thread so that other people can come back and visit. It'll be up in a few hours.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I like it. That's good.
But when you see this threat, you know, this video, you're going to be like, where is all the people? I mean, this place is a ghost town. Even if it was on a Sunday, I mean, you would expect there to be 10 times more people than is shown in this video.
Well, there's more traffic in my local mall on a Tuesday than there is in that video at the World Trade Center.
That's amazing. And you're not living in downtown Chicago or New York?
No, certainly not. Certainly not.
Well,
so how about you?
You guys are doing such original work. I mean, I'm just blown away by this. I think it's utterly fascinating, and you're really making a very plausible case on multiple dimensions for, you know, fakery on a scale almost beyond imagining, just in relation to the Twin Towers.
Is that not the nature of the big lie?
It is. I mean, I thought, you know, all the fakery I'd already unearthed or others, you know, had unearthed together in all of our efforts was impressive, but this is very imposing.
It's a real clever bunch that we're dealing with.
It is. It's utterly fascinating. So you're not going to have real dead people, so you're going to have fake dead people. My God.
Well, fake dead people don't scream for investigations, and they don't sue.
That's right.
And their fake loved ones can further causes approved by you, and there's no end to their uses, even to this day.
I think that's right. And they're the emotional linchpin of the argument. You know, look at all these people who died. I mean, that's probably the question that comes up the most when I talk about, say, something like video fakery. What happened to all the passengers? Where are
right.
they?
And this answers all of those questions very neatly.
It just may. They were phantoms, too. I mean, you know, this is...
Sony Morella Pupolo, she was a friend of the network. She had Bill Clinton and Kerry show up.
Tell me a little bit more about that. Is your supposition that this was somebody who was real, or is it your supposition this is somebody who was fake and the Clintons were props, or what's the deal? Were these?
No, she certainly was real. She was a major Democratic fundraiser, and she was sold in the Portraits of Grief as a former ballet dancer, and that's what everybody would think until we started digging. But she personally hosted fundraising events for all the top Democratic candidates, from Bill Clinton right on through John Kerry in 2000. Her daughter continues to do so to this day. And she was a Hillary for president supporter in the last election, and held a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton at her home in Miami. And the Boston area candidates like Kerry, you know, these people were longtime top contributors to Democratic politics, no question about it. They were extremely connected, you know, certainly for longer than what we know about, but what we've been able to uncover for sure from the Bill Clinton era forward, they were certainly people who, when they rang the phone would get answered.
So, do you have any questions, Jim? Anything that's been bothering
No. I love all this. Now, what do you think about what was her cause of death?
That's a good question. I think it's quite possible that she may fall into the terminally ill.
Yeah.
Relocating category, one or the other.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to say. Her husband has been through several businesses. He and a partner buy businesses that are fragmented. They'll go and buy small businesses across the country in a certain industry, then corner the market, and then take them public. Currently, he's a partner in the largest ambulance service in the country that nearly, if you fall into an ambulance in this country, there's about a 90% chance it'll be one of theirs. And they've taken that company public. These are extremely wealthy people. They have mansions in on the Charles River in Boston. They have the multi-million dollar condos on Biscayne Bay in Miami. The beach houses, the whole nine yards. These are very well connected people, and we know that she didn't fly on flight 11 into the first tower on 9/11.
Fascinating.
Yeah, Sonia Morales Pupolo, she's one of our favorites. You know, I think after the Hackle, you know, McCourt story, I think she's one of my favorites.
Let's go back to your missing contents of the World Trade Center debris pile. 14,700 toilets, sinks, urinals, 45,000 desks, 45,000 chairs, 245 acres of carpeting, 40,000 file cabinets, 40,000 cubicles, 75,000 telephones, 50,000 staplers, 20,000 miles of wiring, 300 mainframe computers, 45,000 computer monitors, 45,000 keyboards, 45,000 mice computer aids, 650 fire extinguishers, 3,000 copy machines, 2,000 water coolers, 3,000 printers, 20,000 doors, 40,000 doorknobs, 22,000 stainless steel elevator doors, 450 refrigerators, 5,000 snack and soda vending machines, 3,000 wallets and purses, 3,000 employee ID cards, 3,000 employee personal cell phones. Where is all that stuff? You're making a hell of a case. I just got to say, you're making a hell of a case.
You know, it's one thing to sit there and say the contents, you know, got nuked or destroyed by directed energy weapons, and we're not knocking any theory. We encourage everybody to continue what they're doing.
Yep.
But as all we're saying is, you know, when you see a list of the stuff,
hey, you guys.
It becomes alive and real.
I'm going to have you back. This is great. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Phil Jahan and Larry McWilliams. I'm going to have him back. You can count on that. Thank you all for listening.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over.